From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the winter of 1939, Artemus Joukowsky's grandfather, a Unitarian minister named Waitstill Sharp, received an invitation, a request by his church to travel to Europe, which was embroiled in the chaos before the war. He and his social worker wife, Martha, were asked to leave the comfort of their home, leave their two kids behind, and help Jews escape the growing Nazi persecution. They hadn't been the first couple asked, by the way. In fact, they were the 18th. But they said yes. And Joukowsky has made a film about this adventure that unfolded and the moral imperative at the heart of it. The film is called Defying the Nazis, and today in the program, our conversation with Joukowsky about his story and about his film. We invite you to join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Artemus Joukowsky's grandparents were amazing. In those early days before World War II broke out in Europe, they traveled there, and they were able to help dozens of people escape the Nazis. It was an incredibly dangerous time, of course. They were in Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia, in Vichy, France. They learned to write secret codes, how to fool the Gestapo, how to shake an informant, work the black market. And Joukowsky was in high school before he learned any of this story, which is probably typical of that generation, not to say much about their war exploits. But it's a story Joukowsky says he wanted to tell. So now he's written a book about it, and he's directed a film, which premiered on PBS. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with Joukowsky about this story he uncovered. He's a businessman and activist in the disabilities community. And along with Ken Burns, he co-directed and is co-producer of this documentary, which is called Defying the Nazis, The Sharps' War. It's available now on demand from Amazon and iTunes. Joukowsky was assigned a school project in high school to write about moral courage. And that is how he found this extraordinary story.
It is kind of so out of the normal situation where you go home and I asked my mom, you know, who should I interview for this project? And she said, you know, talk to your grandmother. She did some amazing things during World War II. And I had never heard the story. It was like a new world had opened up for me. And I just imagine a 14-year-old boy showing up at this elegant lady's home and, you know, interviewing her and then hearing, you know, her exploits of, you know, escorting dissidents and Jews and liberals from the Nazis and getting people up to safety. It blew my mind and it changed my life and in ways that I didn't even know at that time. And one of the fun things for me is that it was the first time I ever got an A in high school.
Right.
So I really had the sense of achieving something that I loved.
Yeah.
And I learned history. I learned history in the way that I've learned to tell it in this story with Ken Burns is not just the sweeps of history, but the individual narratives of history. And to learn about World War II, not through just the, you know, who won what battle and what general did what, but, you know, what are the individual people that we know and connect to? And my grandmother suddenly appeared as an entirely new person.
Yeah. Well, changed your life, though. What do you mean changed your life? I mean, I know in practical ways, but I'm also wondering, because there's this moral imperative at the heart of the film.
Yes.
I'm wondering
yes.
if that changed your life, too.
Yes. And also, at that time, I was also diagnosed as a 14-year-old with a neuromuscular disease called spinal muscular atrophy, SMA. And by the way, Utah is one of the great centers of neuromuscular research in SMA, the University Hospital. So that's where I also went to get my treatments. But what my grandmother did is she came into my bedroom, into the hospital room, and said, "You're not going to feel sorry for yourself. Let's go help other people." And suddenly her narrative, the kind of person she was, showed up to me as someone who would not just encourage me to do things for others, but would learn that by giving to others, you give to yourself, that the true legacy of life is about your love.
grandmother's name was Martha. Your grandfather's name, it's a great name, Waitstill. Yes. What is that? Yeah. That's like an old Puritan New England name, yeah?
And I think it was chosen because my great-grandfather, Dallas Lorsharp, who was a naturalist and wrote in the same style of John Burroughs' nature books about families, wanted Waitstill to learn to wait and be still. And so it's very much kind of a play on words that relates to, you know, observing nature and being connected to what is around you.
When you went to talk to your grandfather about all of this, because he had never said anything about it either,
right.
What was the reaction like? Both of them, your grandmother and grandfather, you've written about the fact that they kind of brushed it off. Like, look, something needed to be done, and we did. But this was interesting. You write in your book that for your grandfather, the past only interested him insofar as it illuminated the present.
Right. And this is part of what you learn in stories like this, where, you know, you understand that history is not about something that happened. It's just something that's important today. Mm. What is important about history is that it does teach us. We are able to observe patterns over time. And what I learned from him was the individual stories. You know, you think about 6 million people having been killed during the Holocaust, and that's just a big abstract number. Yeah. But when you break it down, like William Blake would say, that the whole world is in a grain of sand, you start to see the individual lives. And as Ken Burns would say, the potentiality of the lives that were rescued.
Mm. There's a really sort of beautiful moment that comes a little bit later in the film, and I want to play a section from this. This is the actor, Marina Goldman, actor and activist, and she reads the part of your grandmother from letters. And we'll talk about how you bring the story to life through their own voices here in just a moment. But we'll hear her talking about this. It's that moment when you act, when you have to decide to act. Mm-hmm. So let me play this moment first, and so we can talk a little bit about it. This is from Artemis Joyowski's film, Defying the Nazis, The Sharps War.
Every life we touched had its own drama. One can only manage a miracle every so often. But a series of miracles can happen when many people become concerned and are willing to act at the right time.
It's almost like this is the motto for the film in some way, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I think, like any evolution of a personal story, they didn't know how to do that the first moment they got there.
Yeah.
They learned by helping others what the underground looked like and how to work with different groups like the Quakers or the Red Cross or, you know, one thing you do see deeply in this story are the interconnections between all the different groups that the Sharps worked with to rescue a life. And every group played their role, and every individual played their role in the capacity that they could. And that notion of what Martha's saying about miracles is that miracles is about the best intentions of people, the best work of people, and that 1 + 1 = 3, and particularly in saving a life.
But throughout the film, you get this sense that there are these two different realities going on in Europe in those early days. Now, of course, later during World War II, when America gets involved in the war, America starts to understand deeply the atrocities going on in the camps, those kinds of things. That becomes pretty clear. But there's this reality that in the days as the sort of, the Nazi menace is gathering, there's one thing going on in Europe. And then in America, there, as you mentioned, your grandmother mentions, they're worried about baseball, the sort of day-to-day kinds of things. And the question comes up time and time again in the film, how much did Americans know about what was really going on? How much did we choose to know about what was really going on? So I wanted you to talk about that sort of element of the film.
Yeah, I think this is a story that explores those questions directly. Clearly, the most frustrating part of my grandparents' work was that the U.S. State Department did not cooperate in many of the rescue cases that they felt were political refugees, people who would have been killed by the Nazis. Of course, we now know that any Jew would have been killed by the Nazis. But in that time, the U.S. State Department was in denial about that. Mm-hmm. The Sharps knew. You know, they saw it on the ground. And they, you know, suffered deeply for all the lives they could not help. So I think this was part of the dynamic of this story, was that there were these terrible impediments. And clearly the anti-Semitism mm-hmm. that came out of the kind of the Father Coughlin's ranting of how the Jews had created the Depression had created a certain kind of a view of Jews in America that was very destructive in this manner. Yeah. And the Sharps felt offended by that. You know, Unitarians are believers in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Mm. And so they felt very much connected as a humanist to the human drama of other people who were suffering. But in particular, they saw that Jews were going to be exterminated. And they, you know, wanted to do everything they could to stop that.
This is another important, I think, part of the film, understanding the Unitarian perspective, because your grandfather, Waite Still, was an abiding Unitarian. He believed absolutely in the ideas. And I want to play another moment from the film. We should mention that Waite Still, Sharp, is read by Tom Hanks in the film, so you'll hear his voice here. We'll also hear in this this particular clip the Unitarian Reverend Jack Mendelson talking about Waite Still goes to law school. And as he talks about in this moment, he didn't really ever feel quite at home there. It's the Unitarian Church where he finds his calling, and this these ideas of reason and freedom. Let me play another moment from the film.
I had never felt at home in law school. I took my degree with lasting gratitude for its stern training in analytical and conceptual thinking. But all that time, I had felt a joy in the conducting of service, in work with children, in the friendship and purpose of the Free Church. After graduating from Harvard Law School, I found my true calling.
Waite Still Sharp was the kind of minister I wanted to be. That is, he wasn't just the minister of a parish church. He was a civic figure. He was interested in the community in which he worked. He was interested in world affairs. He was interested in the need for peace in the world.
Reason and freedom are the guidelines for our reverence. We are working here at a new adventure. The organization of a church under the governments of reason and freedom, with the democracy of the American town meeting as its form and spirit.
What does he mean, a new adventure? I mean, this seemed to drive him.
Well, he viewed, I think, the liberation of the human spirit as the credo of his spiritual teachings. And, yeah. and that comes from this notion that Jesus, of course, was a Jew and a great prophet, but not necessarily the Son of God. And for Unitarians, they believe that humans are the manifestations of our own destinies,
yeah.
and that reason and understanding of difference is at the core of that, because toleration of difference is what allows humans to live together.
The shape of human history is in human hands, is its point.
Right.
Yeah. What was it like to hear your grandfather preach a sermon?
Oh, my gosh. It was, you know, one of those moments in my life where I was searching myself for the meaning of my life and how I would serve others. He was always talking about, you know, the work he had done to support civil rights, to help advocate for the U.S. to get out of the Vietnam War, whatever it might be. It was always about, you know, this liberation of the human spirit, this idea that each human being has to find their own liberation, and also has to be in a community of love to allow that liberation to happen. And so there's this interplay between the individual and the community where 1 + 1 = 3, where we evolve into a better human being, where we learn altruism, where we take care of each other. And he had a belief deeply that humans had that potentiality, that we could create over time a community and a society based on these Unitarian ideas. Mm. You know, Unitarians are not ever about converting people to Unitarianism, because they're not looking to grow the religion in that way. They're looking for each human being, whether they're Catholic or Jewish or Muslim, to liberate their own spirits. So it's more of a movement than a church. It's more of a calling. And really, in the end, it's a covenant you make with your community, a community where you live in a civil society together, where you have arbitrations and where you deal fairly with difference and disagreement. And that's what my grandparents both fought for all their lives and modeled for me as their grandson. Mm.
It's interesting. Your grandfather, you said, would read the New York Times every day.
Yes.
And that sense of awareness of what was going on in the world, like knowing what was happening so you can't look away.
Right.
That seemed important to him.
Yes,
and he was. Mom too, your grandmother too.
You know, and that's a very Unitarian kind of education, is to be engaged, not just in your local community, but in the world community, because you knew that the world affected your local community and that not every civil right would be guaranteed by yourself. You had to rely on other people to interpret fairly and justly the laws of the land. That's one of the most interesting things as a Harvard law graduate, that he goes and justifies breaking the law to save a life in a immoral society. So I think one of the things that the Sharps are very concerned about is morality and ethics, and what is the right way for people to cohabitate together. Mm.
Your grandfather died before you were able to conduct a really extensive interview. Your grandmother, you also wanted to. You had a nice interview with her, but you wanted to get more, and ultimately she was suffering from dementia. So you had to find another way to capture their voices. And at some point, you got really lucky and found this treasure trove of letters and things. Talk about finding that and using those voices as part of the film.
Yeah. Well, in 1999, my grandmother died, and her obituary was published in the local newspaper. And I got a phone call from a filmmaker from Keene State, Larry Benequist, and he said, you know, we're interested in making a film about your grandmother. And I said, well, it just so happens that I'm going to go to her home next week to bring her papers to Brown University's library. And I said, would you come with me? Because I need help. I'm not strong to lift these boxes. But more importantly, I'd love for you to see what the documentation looks like. And little did we know, we go into the basement and find 14 boxes of the real material of rescue, the documents, the affidavits, the copies of passports, names, people that they tried to help, and we were overwhelmed. I had never seen documents like that. And then when we called the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C., we said, we'd like you to see these documents as well. And before you know it, they become very excited and passionate to help us archive these documents. And what these documents show is the real stuff of life. Yeah. This is how people actually got into America, or these are the papers. And you see that rescue was a very bureaucratic process. It really was about filling out many, many forms and doing it properly. And then at times, of course, falsifying forms so you could get someone out.
I want to come back to that point because I think it's an important one. Just how, I think in a digital age, we take for granted, you know, you can fill out a form online. But, I mean, they were having to type out forms and in fountain pen, and it really comes across in the film. And we'll get to the story when we get back from a break. Artemis Jakowski, along with Ken Burns, co-directed and co-produced the film Defying the Nazis, The Sharps War. It premiered on PBS in the fall. It's now available for streaming in Amazon and in iTunes. We should also mention Joukowsky wrote a book about all of this. You can find all the links to all of that information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the story of Wait Still and Martha Sharp. He, a Unitarian minister, she, a social worker. And in the 1930s, when things began to look dark for Jews in Germany as Hitler took control, the Sharps left the comfort of their home in New England and went to Europe to help people escape the Nazis. A film made by the Sharps' grandson, Artemas Joukowsky, tells this story. He, along with Ken Burns, co-produced and co-directed the film. It's called Defying the Nazis, The Sharps' War. And we'll give you details about watching it online, which you can do now as we go along. Artemas Joukowsky, let's talk about the story. Take us to 1939. What is happening in Europe at the time? And maybe you can get us to this phone call that your grandfather receives.
Exactly. Well, of course, you know, the Kristallnacht, the terrible days of burning of synagogues and killing of Jews occurred in November of 1938. So the world knew what was coming. And as the refugees start fleeing away from Austria and Germany, particularly Jews and social democrats, they go to Prague. Prague becomes overrun by refugees, and the Unitarian Church of Prague, led by a very charismatic man named Norbert Chopek, mm-hmm. calls the American Unitarians and says, please send us Americans. We don't need money. We need Americans. We need help. And so the church goes about trying to find a couple, a husband and a wife, to leave their parish and go to Europe as their representatives to their sister church in Prague. And they ask 17 ministers, and they all say no, and then call my grandparents on this fateful night in February and invite my mom, my grandmother, and grandfather to come speak with the leadership of the church about going to Europe to help their sister church. And I think it was a very, very hard decision.
Yeah.
I think Wait Still was excited about the idea of fighting the Nazis and helping social democrats escape. I think for Martha, it really was very difficult to choose between her husband's passion and her children.
Yeah.
My mom was 2 years old at that time, and my uncle was six. So this was a big decision for them to leave their children to go to Europe.
It's interesting that tension comes into play later in the story. And we'll get to that, or at least as much as you want to reveal. But how much of this, I mean, a lot of this is about just the sort of cloak and dagger things that are going on, the story of escapes and all of that. But then the other part of it is kind of a love story.
Exactly. It is a love story. I mean, this is, I don't want to ruin the film for anyone. So if you need a spoiler alert, just know that I'm going to say something. But one of the reasons I didn't know this story is my grandparents get divorced.
Yeah.
And it's a sad part of the story. So I did not know my grandparents had ever been together. I did not know of their relationship at all. And in making this film, I had a chance to really read their love letters to each other and how much they cared for each other. And that was itself a discovery, because by the time I was born, they had remarried other people. And so I never knew them together. So part of this story is about bringing them together to tell this story together. And you feel like you're with them because, you know, the story is very, very much narrated by their own journey.
Yeah.
And so that's the journey I went on as well.
I mean, he writes to her these beautiful letters. You are beautiful and a brick. He
mm-hmm.
calls her his Venus and Minerva cast into one statue.
Right. It's
really beautiful, this interplay. But then also you sense that there are these long silences.
There,
and
right.
we'll get to this, but there are these moments when they have to separate. his passion to want to do this and her kind of reluctance. It's really complicated.
Right. It is complicated. Life is complicated.
Yeah.
So what we're trying to show in almost a very humanitarian way, and this is, I think, the brilliance of Ken Burns, is that he shows history through these very personal, intimate views of reality that then are contextualized in this larger story of what happens in the world. And suddenly you understand that history is about these large sweeps of movement, but mm-hmm. they are millions of people and individual stories that make up that history. And that's what you learn from this story as well.
Yeah. Your grandmother's family rejects her when she decides right. she wants to go to college. Not just that. They throw her belongings out the window and say right. she's no longer welcome in the house?
Unbelievable. You know, this was the burgeoning era of feminism at this stage in kind of American history. And, you know, my grandmother wanted to give back to her family. It wasn't a lack of appreciation. It was she had a vision for her life, yeah. and she knew getting a college education was a gift of a lifetime. And as a full scholarship student, she jumped at the chance. She was working class, grew up in the streets of Providence, and always had a vision by going to church in at the Baptist meeting house in Providence that she would become a medical missionary.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the most beautiful things that we share in the film is her high school yearbook where she declares that she is a good suffragist.
Right.
And that women should be in the house about 50% of the time.
Right. I love that. Well, she's sort of trying to find a good middle ground. I believe a woman's place is in the home, but only half the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so this is the model of a voice, you know, without Pembroke College, which is part of Brown University, mm-hmm. that opportunity for women would not have existed. And I think she found her voice there. And she also met a very wonderful family that really adopted her called the Stebbinses. Livingston Stebbins was the publisher of Beacon Press at the time and a leading Unitarian.
Wow.
And really took Martha under her wing during her Brown University years. And when she graduated, wanted to introduce her to the up-and-coming star of the Unitarian Education Department, Wastel Sharp.
Hmm.
So they are introduced and fall in love in the midst of getting their degrees and also declaring that their lives are about serving others.
Yeah. I want to get back to this question we were talking about earlier. That is, when does word get out to the Americans of what's really going on? Czechoslovakia in particular, the Sudetenland, Hitler, of course, wants to bring Germans in that region sort of back into the fold. And so, you know, he starts his adventures. We know about that part. But what did Americans know at that time? And I want to play a moment here where this is the voice of your grandfather read by Tom Hanks. Talking about that, you get a sense in what he's saying here at this moment that Americans do know enough to do something. Here's another moment from the film, Defying the Nazis, the Sharps' War.
The immediate cause of Unitarian intervention in overseas evil is the situation in Czechoslovakia. What are we going to do? Their plight's desperate. Absolutely desperate. It is too late to turn our back on what we know is happening. Houses being rifled. People being beaten up. Their lives made intolerable, miserable, with nobody to help them at all. My friends, I stand before you today and declare war on Nazi Germany. Face the evil that faces us.
Now, we should point out, he's, of course, declaring this war there, I suppose, from the pulpit or something.
Right.
Before the United States actually makes a declaration. That's got to have been amazing.
Yes. And you know, as a pacifist, he becomes convinced that the only way to end Hitler is not just to go there himself, but to encourage and engage the United States to get involved in stopping Hitler.
Yeah.
And this was a question for him of right versus wrong, of morality. And so he declares war from the pulpit. Imagine that, you know, as a Unitarian. I think the congregation was overwhelmed by that notion that a Unitarian had, let's say, the tenacity or the chutzpah to declare war, you know, from the pulpit. But he did. And then with his wife goes to Europe and starts to jump into this horrific calamity of oppression.
Yeah. They leave for Europe and they go to London, where they learn. This is great because your grandmother talks to you about this later when you learn about the story. They learn to make these memos and they get these key words, and it was like learning to be a spy almost.
Exactly. The first trip across the ocean, they go to London. They meet with the Quakers and the Unitarians based there who are involved in rescue. They already know that there's a major refugee crisis emerging from the oppression of the Nazis, and they start to say, "You will be followed. You will be searched. You will be interrogated. You will be spied on by the Nazis. So get ready and learn some spycraft. Learn how to disguise your names. Burn your data." And that's one of the most amazing parts of the story is that every time my grandparents helped someone escape, they would burn the documents. So we never had any of the documents of the people they rescued. Many of those people we've had to find since that time. So that's been part of the most remarkable piece of this storytelling, is to find these people through private detectives, through interviews. We found 30 people who make up our story.
Which is remarkable. And we'll talk about some of those people here in a moment. But let's just get back to that thing that you were talking about earlier, just the kind of grunt work that they had to really go through, the paperwork basically that they were doing.
Right.
I mean, and when you think about the work that had to be done, I mean, you have thousands of people who are looking to get out. And what your grandparents have to do is try to get in touch with different countries to see if you can arrange visas and work permits. And before we sort of get to another moment of the film, which I want to play, it's hard not to relate this to what's going on today in the refugee crisis happening with the Syrians.
Exactly.
Is it not? Yeah.
Exactly. And this film, I think, helps to humanize the current refugee crisis, because each of these people, it's not just that there's 65 million refugees today, but each of these stories have the same integrity, the same human need for shelter and food and protection. And this would have been a call of arms for the Sharps as it was then, as it is today.
Mm. Here's another moment. We'll hear Marina Goldman reading the voice of Martha Sharp. We'll also hear the Holocaust scholar Deborah Dwork.
We had lists of thousands of names, all of them requesting exit visas. But it wasn't as easy as simply requesting a visa from a foreign country. Through our contacts in Boston, New York, London, and other cities, we had to arrange for jobs, places to live. We had to match refugees in Prague with opportunities to live and work abroad.
They knew that their mission was material relief, and also to help those in danger get out.
Yeah, I mean, it's like material support, you know?
Right.
I mean, and it becomes dangerous and all of those kinds of things, but a lot of it just seems like they must have had like 13, 14, 15-hour days where they're just pounding typewriters and making telephone calls.
Exactly. And that really changes. So they arrive, you know, February 23rd, they know the Nazis are at the border. And then March 15th, everything changes.
Yeah.
The Nazis invade, and their work goes from really supporting refugees to getting people out. They know that people are in danger. And these are both social democrats as well as Jews who will be killed by the Nazis.
Powerful moment. In fact, Martha talks about going to the airport. This is in March. And she says what she sees has this really profound effect on the rest of her life. I want to play this moment But set this up for us. She goes to the airport, and there's a transport plane that had been arranged to take children out of the area.
This is the remarkable work of a man named Nicholas Winton, who was a stockbroker from London who went on a vacation into Czech Republic and realized that there was a refugee crisis and decides to take it upon himself to create a Kinder transport. And she witnesses this Kinder transport. And what's beautiful about our film is we were able to get the actual footage of the day that Martha is there.
Wow.
And the day that Gerda Meyer, the storyteller of this piece, is able to describe the last time she saw her mother and father alive before she flies away to freedom. And they, of course, later are killed by the Nazis. So this is a very poignant moment in the story where Martha realizes, I've got to help children. They are the victims of war. We have to get children out as soon as possible. And that really becomes her mission for the rest of the entire work that they do, not just in 1939 and 1940, as you said, but throughout the war until the end of the war.
Nicholas Winton had arranged a Kinder transport plane that was to leave from Prague and carry children as well as documents I'd brought to the airport. The parents had brought sweets and other small gifts while saying the mundane things that are usually said before parting. Be good. We'll be together soon. All the while, knowing they might not see them again.
Times were so desperate. People were very thankful if they could get their children onto the transports. I do remember at the airport, my mother was walking up and down with my sister arm in arm, rather pensively. Then also that we had our sort of last meal. And my father took photographs.
The plane was announced. As each child stepped off the exit, he or she waved to their parents, ran across the snow-covered field, waved again, and climbed aboard the plane. The parents' self-control was incredible. Smiling brightly, eyes brimming with tears, they waved back.
There's one image I want to point out, Artemis, that is kind of haunting, and it's this mother. I think she's waving, but you can see she's trying to put on a brave face, but she looks terrified, and it's really, really sad.
Yeah. Imagine the courage it took of those parents to realize this was the only way to save their children and to say goodbye to them and put them on a plane and not know whether they would ever see them again.
Yeah.
I mean, it must have been heartbreaking.
And Gerda, of course, her mother and her family, they end up dying in Auschwitz. And I just want to ask you, some are willing to talk about it, some don't. And Gerda didn't really want to, as she says, dwell upon it.
Right. I think that's one of the subtexts of this whole story. It's not just this story. It's all the World War II stories. This was, you know, a war that we have kind of romanticized in a sense because of our victory and how America came out of that war. But I think for many people of that generation who lived through it, it was a terrible calamity. They lost so many people they loved. The world that they knew was over. And kind of an age of innocence was complete for America. And I think for my grandparents, both of them suffered from post-traumatic stress. I think they felt overwhelmed by what they had seen. The first trip was an invitation to go, but the second trip was kind of a demand by the church to go.
Yeah.
So their reluctance is also based on the fact that they're a mother and a father, and they have two children, and they have to stay alive themselves. You know, they can't be caught. So the moment they hear that they're going to be arrested on the first trip, they leave. And as soon as they can get these 27 children out, my grandmother leaves and realizes this is as much as I can do on this tour of duty because I'm also a mom and I have to be there for my own children.
It's Artemis Jakowski, who along with Ken Burns co-directed and co-produced the film Defying the Nazis, The Sharps War, which premiered on PBS. This was last fall. It's now available for streaming on Amazon and on iTunes. And on our website, you can find links to all of that, as well as to Joukowsky's book, by the way, of the same name. Just visit us at radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the activist and film producer Artemis Joukowsky. We're talking about his documentary, which he co-produced and co-directed with Ken Burns. It's called Defying the Nazis, The Sharps' War.
I want to play another moment. So they, as you say, they come back, your grandparents, Martha and Waitstill, and they're sort of back in the warmth of their home. The war hasn't come to the United States yet, of course, but things in Europe are worse than ever. And as you say, at first it was an invitation to go, and now it becomes something else. Like, you guys need to go back. Waitstill tries to protest. He tries to say, you know, we've got two kids. We can't really do this. And he protests at first, but he kind of gives in. And this is a really important moment. He kind of imposes this idea on his wife. And I want to play this moment. It's this moment, Artemis, where she says, I said no. Right. Do you want to set this up for us?
Yes. Well, you know, the situation was worse than ever. All the people that they'd helped to get out of Prague, many of them went to France thinking that was safe. And now the Germans, of course, are invading France. Yeah. And so they start to flee to the south, and this massive refugee problem begins with all these refugees from Belgium, from France, from Austria. And many of the characters in our film get to southern France, to Marseille, where, of course, there's no food, people are starving, and the city of Marseille goes from 50,000 to, let's say, 400,000.
Wow.
So it's just overwhelmed by people. And so, again, the call goes out for someone to go and help these people. And again, really the only people that were qualified to help were Martha and Waitstill. So this piece you're going to hear is really about this command from the church. Now we're not inviting. Now we are, you know, desperate. And we need you to help us, because these are our people that we need to save.
And I said no. We had just been away months before, and I had left my two children, and I really didn't want to go again. And so I sat in the church and was amazed when Frederick Elliot announced that Waitstill and Martha Sharp would go back to Europe. I thought we had decided together not to go.
We agreed, with serious misgivings about our children, that we would go.
But this is an important moment, because it seems, and maybe this wasn't, maybe it was more complicated than that, but it seems like this was a breaking point for them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what happened on this trip was both a very difficult decision, again, to leave, knowing that they are going to face danger in a way that they did not understand the first trip.
Yeah.
But at the same time, realizing that time really is ticking for so many people. And so they arrive in Lisbon, make their way to southern France. Their first work is to provide milk for the starving babies of Pau. And what's so remarkable about this story is that it really is about this social work, a vision that Martha had, not to let the milk that they brought in to be taken by Nazis, but to be really facilitated to local midwives. Mm. And they're able to feed 800 children over the course of that year and keep them alive. And then, of course, the problem of getting people out. So Waitstill becomes very involved in this initial creation with Varian Fry of the Emergency Rescue Committee of helping these dissidents who would have been killed by the Nazis. And, of course, that story is, you know, what really starts Waitstill in this process of rescuing a man named Leon Furchtwanger.
Yeah. he's a novelist, a playwright, and there's a great, we don't need to give too much away about this amazing escape over the mountains. It's a fascinating part of the story. But I do want to play this moment, which I loved from the film. It's a conversation that Waite Still tells with Leon Feuchtwanger. They have to sort of bribe these border guards, and they go through this. They have to take the smuggler's route across over the map. It's a great story. But Leon is wondering what's motivating Waite Still. Let me play this moment because I think it's a great response. Here's another moment from the film.
Leon Feuchtwanger came home in the lower berth of my little stateroom, which was to have been occupied by Martha Sharp. The first evening on the boat, he looked at me and, smiling inquisitively, said, "May I address you, sir, as though you were a character in one of my novels? Why are you here, doing what you are doing? How much are you paid? Is there a payoff here from some agency?" I said, "I'm not paid any salary at all. I think something frightful, in addition to what has befallen Europe, is going to befall now. I'm not a saint. I'm just as capable of the many sins of human nature as anyone else. But I believe that the will of God is to be interpreted by the liberty of the human spirit." "Well, this is a surprising answer," he said. "You get enough reward out of that?" I said, "Yes, I do. Our lives, including my life and certainly my liberties, are in the hands of somebody. And I don't like to see guys get pushed around."
It sort of defines the way he saw the world, doesn't it?
Absolutely. You know, he viewed, as he said, the liberation of the human spirit to be not just your individual possibility, but the possibility of a loving community, a tolerant community. And that was very much what he was fighting for by going to Europe and by helping people who were not being given the right to live in a tolerant world. And all that beauty of Europe, all that remarkable art and music and you know, the such a center of tremendous culture was basically extinguished by this attempt to wipe out a whole group of people. And my grandfather felt offended by that and motivated to do whatever he could to help these innocent people.
You hear the first part of that exchange. He says, "This, you know, I was in my cabin, which was supposed to have also been occupied by Martha, by my wife." And of course, they're separated. And it's a kind of a poignant thing. We hear these moments where he's sort of pleading with her to return. I'm alone. And as you mentioned, they eventually end up sort of breaking up. But this question comes up in the film later. You know, would Waite Still have done it over again? Would Martha have done it over again? I mean, as he says, he tells someone that you include in the film, it destroyed his marriage, but it was also at the same time the most extraordinary experience of his life.
Right. I think that, you know, that is one of the lessons of the film, that ordinary people can do extraordinary things. And Waite Still was a person who certainly wasn't ordinary. None of us are ordinary. We're all unique and special. But the point is that all of us are human beings, and we all have the sins of human nature, as he says in that statement. We all have the same temptations. And, of course, human nature is what it is, but it's what we do with it, and it's how we choose to learn, and it's how we choose to be inspired by altruism. You know, one thing you learn from this story is that altruism is really a choice.
Yeah.
It's really about identity and what you choose to support in your life. And those examples come through very powerfully in both Martha and Waite Still's personal journey.
Your mother asked you once, "What are you doing in your life that's important?"
Right. Yeah, and I would say, you know, "How about graduate from the eighth grade? Was that good enough?" And she would say, "No, we're not talking about graduating from the eighth grade. You're going to graduate from the eighth grade. We're talking about what are you going to do that's important for others."
It's Artemis Jakowski. who, along with Ken Burns, co-directed and co-produced the film Defying the Nazis, The Sharps' War. He's also written a book about all of this. The documentary is available for streaming on Amazon and on iTunes. You can find links on our website to that and to the book, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.